Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. One of the hottest books in the country these days is a new biography of an amazing woman. It's Catherine the Great. The book is Portrait of a Woman. It was written by Robert K. Massey, and he joins us today on the program. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much.
Every time I look at the bestseller list, I see your book on there, and it really makes me feel good to know that so many people are reading this kind of a book. What do you think?
What do you think any author is going to say? I'm delighted that they're reading it, and I agree with you. It's not my book. It's her life, her story that's so extraordinary, and I think it's extraordinary for people today, women today, particularly maybe. But it is as I think you say, an extraordinary life.
I understand that your interest in Russian history began in a very deeply personal way. Can you tell our listeners how that occurred?
Yes, I can. My oldest child, my son Bob Jr., was born almost 50 years ago with hemophilia, the bleeding disease, which was also a problem for Nicholas II, the last Russian Tsar's only son, Alexei. Mm. And I had a background in history from college and graduate studies, and I was therefore very interested. I didn't know much beyond the simple that the boy had this problem, and that Rasputin, the false monk, was involved, et cetera, et cetera. So I was working as a journalist at Newsweek. I started spending my lunch hours at the New York Public Library and reading. And I thought it was not only fascinating, but really unknown. Nobody knew what hemophilia was. Nobody knew how the family had tried to deal with it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I wrote my first book, which was called Nicholas and Alexandra. It was published almost 40 years ago. I'm an old guy, but it was a big success. So I left journalism and started writing books.
And you've gone on to write a number of books, including a few about Russian history. We have books about Peter the Great, the Romanovs. And I'm guessing you probably were saving Catherine because you knew this was going to be such a wonderful project.
Well, yes and no. They proceeded just sort of, fortuitously. After Nicholas and Alexandra, I wrote Peter the Great because he was such an astonishing figure and a great figure in Russian history and also in European history when he brought Russia into Europe. And then I left Russia alone for a while. And then came the discovery of the, I'm sure you remember, the Romanov bones in Siberia. And the question was whether these were the bones. So I became a journalist again and went to Siberia and went to various laboratories where the DNA validity was being established and so forth. And then my publisher and other publishers said, well, Massey seems to want to do Russia again. So they and I decided that that it would be useful and fun and maybe profitable for them to do Catherine. And I was a little bit slow to react. I thought, am I really going to go back into the whole Russian cultural scene and so forth? But I tell you, when I began with her memoirs, she was a brilliant intellectual woman and a great writer. She wrote her own memoirs covering the first half of her life. She wrote them during the second half when she was empress. And they are brilliant. They're colorful, they're precise, they're human, and I can't really say fell in love, but I was enormously attracted by her honesty and the story. And I thought, I am really lucky to have decided to do this.
In case you've just tuned in, Robert K. Massey is our guest. His new biography, Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. One would have never thought that she could have done so much. She came from somewhat humble beginnings for a member of the nobility.
Yes, she did. She was a little German girl, and she was a princess, but in the 18th century, and really for much of Germany's existence, princesses were a dime a dozen, and the princesses of little principalities and grand duchies and electorates and so forth often became the brides of other European princes, some of which were going to be kings and so forth. And this was what happened to Catherine. She was brought to Russia by Peter the Great's daughter, Empress Elizabeth, to be the mother of an heir. She was going to marry Catherine off to her nephew. And Catherine went to Russia at 14, was married at 16, and then found out that her designated husband, the man she was going to be engaged to and marry, wasn't much of a man and wasn't much of a husband. And she had to put up with all that for many, many years.
And he ultimately became Peter III. He was a very strange fellow, and we learned so much about him. What a bizarre character he was.
Yeah, so bizarre and so strange that one can almost go right around the circle and feel sorry for him. He didn't want to be in Russia. He was brought there by his aunt Elizabeth, the Empress. He was a German prince. He was actually the son of Elizabeth's elder sister, who had died, also the daughter of Peter. So this Peter III, as you said, was Peter the Great's grandson. But he had none of the characteristics, the power, the imagination, the assertiveness of Peter the Great. And Catherine was stuck with him.
And a lot of these potential heirs, these royals, were damaged by their childhoods. He's one, their son Paul. I guess I use their son Paul loosely.
That's an interesting question you allude to.
Yes, she was the mother, Catherine of Paul. We'll get into the lovers later.
Okay.
I thought the Empress Elizabeth was an amazing person.
Well, she was. There were no evident or available male heirs other than this inadequate Peter. And Elizabeth was on the throne. If I can just divert for a minute, I just wanted to make a very interesting point as to why Russia had four empresses during the 18th century. This was a decision made by Peter the Great, who was all-powerful, and he decided that it wasn't sufficient, it wasn't a good idea, actually, to have only males succeed to the throne, to the sovereign throne, to be the Gosudar, Gosudarina. And he changed the law of succession in the dynasty so that the male or he could name anybody, male or female. And Peter the Great named his wife, the peasant woman who had become his wife and who succeeded on Peter's death and as Catherine the First. Our Catherine the Great, was actually Catherine the Second. But there were, as a result of this decision by Peter the Great, four Russian empresses during the 18th century. Catherine the Great was the last because her son, Paul, with whom she had difficulties back and forth through most of his adult life, when he succeeded as Paul the First, he changed the law back and said only males can succeed. I just thought that was an interesting factor. People wonder why the four empresses and never thereafter.
Paul was a little bit bitter. In case you've just tuned in, Robert Massey has joined us. His new biography is Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. We have this bizarre marriage where Catherine is essentially married to this guy who sleeps in her bed with her, yet for many years, the Empress Elizabeth is waiting for an heir to be born. But there's a problem, a big problem.
There is a problem. It's both a psychological and a physical problem. The result is that, as you said, Catherine and Peter slept in the same bed together for 9 years, and he never touched her. It was a physical problem which made making love painful and difficult for him. He liked women, he chased women, but he never carried through to the the ultimate relationship with a woman until later in his life, after he had sort of abandoned Catherine. Therefore, the Empress Elizabeth had to provide or insist that Catherine produce a child with somebody else. Now, the great, still unanswered historical question is whether Peter, restored to sexual ability and health, came back to Catherine, and together they fathered Paul. I mean, they had Paul, and or whether she had a relationship with another young man designated by the Empress to fulfill her objective of producing an heir. And that has never been totally resolved by historians. And you can imagine that Russians are very interested because it brings up the whole question or the decision as to whether the Romanov dynasty continued until the end or whether it was actually the Saltykov dynasty, the other candidate for being the father of Paul was a young man named Sergei Saltykov. And that, I try and lay out all the facts on both sides, or all the assumptions, suppositions, and so forth, and I leave it there for the reader to puzzle over along with everyone else.
The strongest evidence that I could see just as a casual observer was these wonderful portraits that you included, and I must say that Catherine's first lover, the Saltykov gentleman, certainly has a very close facial resemblance to her son, Paul.
Well, people often observe that. They also look at Peter, I don't see this quite as much, and say there's a resemblance there. And the stronger argument on behalf of Peter's paternity is that Paul sort of copied his father in his tastes. He was pro-German. He dressed his guards in German uniforms. He desperately admired Frederick the Great, as his father had. And when he became emperor in 1762, he immediately ended the war that Russia was fighting with Germany and became Frederick the Great's ally overnight, as it were, which was part of the reason that the Russian army and the Guards regiments helped to overthrow him.
This is fascinating stuff, and there's so much in this book. We have this young woman who is so intelligent and so ambitious, and she puts up with what is essentially a loveless marriage. They're friends for a while, but they grow apart, and he flaunts his lovers in front of her, and they kind of have an arrangement, don't they, where they both overlook the things that are going on between various people in the court?
Well, not only overlook. I mean, remember when she took as a lover this handsome Polish diplomat, Stanislaus Poniatowski, Peter accepted him. And they actually, the husband and the wife, each with their own lovers, would have suppers together. It was what the French call a ménage à quatre.
Mm.
And very strange.
Amazing.
But there it was.
Yeah. And the intrigues, when we get into the middle of the book, and she is now empress, and we find out how that happened, this is just such an amazing story. I think one of my favorite parts about it is Peter was fascinated by fires, and you make the point that Moscow was all these wooden structures and a lot of fires burning all the time, and apparently Peter III was a fire bug, and this ally of Catherine's started a fire in his own house knowing that Peter would run to it.
Yes, that was because Catherine was pregnant by her very long-term lover, then Gregory Orlov, a guards officer, and she didn't want anybody to know. She was Peter was the Tsar, and he was very hostile to Catherine by then. He was threatening to divorce her by sending her to a convent. And when she was going to have this baby, she had a faithful retainer servant who thought that the way to get Peter totally out of the palace was to burn his own house down, and that almost certainly the Tsar would rush off to watch, which happened, and this little illegitimate child was born and then hustled out of the palace to be brought up by the family of this retainer. He actually had a successful sort of in not very important life, but that was the kind of thing people... The people around Catherine admired her greatly. It wasn't just that they disliked and despaired of Peter. They wanted her. She was so intelligent. She came up with such good ideas. And she saved Peter's. She pulled his irons out of the fire a number of times. She was obviously equipped to rule. He was obviously a disaster. And so, as you were saying, this coup d'etat came along almost with the force of nature, of destiny.
I love the portrait of her as the coup is unfolding, and she's in her uniform on her horse. What a legendary picture.
Yeah. She marched out to the suburban palace where Peter was with 14,000 soldiers marching behind her, and he liked to think of himself as a soldier, but his main soldiering was done with toy soldiers or dressed up servants and so forth. And he surrendered immediately. He abdicated on her demand, and then she sent him off to a country house. And I don't know whether you want to go into what happened there or not, but within a week he was dead. And she was the Empress of Russia.
How much time do you have, sir? We could do a two-hour interview on this book. There's so much here.
Well, I have as long as you want.
Well, we might turn this into two segments at this rate, so we'll just keep talking. How about that?
Fine.
Excellent. There's so much in this book, and the wars when she becomes Empress, the partitions of Poland, her lover becoming the king of Poland.
Well, he didn't just become. She put him on the throne, yeah.
Exactly. There's so much here, and I'm really intrigued by this kind of history because I'm fascinated by a particular geographic area, and every time you mention East Prussia or Lithuania or Livonia or Riga, that whole area along the Baltic, I just perk up and There are so many elements here that we have heard about. I can remember as a kid hearing legends about Catherine the Great, and one of them is one that obviously never happened, but it's one the kids used to talk about, and something about a horse. That's not in the book. Obviously, it never happened. We hear that the legend of the Potemkin villages, you address that. But was Potemkin her real love of her life?
Yes, he was, definitely. And he may well have been. There's strong evidence that he was actually her husband. It would have been a morganatic marriage, that they were quietly married one night. He was an extraordinary man, and she knew this when she met him. But she didn't marry him or even sort of have him become her favorite, which was the term at the Russian court for sort of a designated, publicly recognized lover. For a number of years, he was 10 years younger than she, and he was an army officer. He was fighting the Turks in the Balkans and along the Black Sea coast. And when he came back, there's a good story. He was a brilliant man intellectually, as well as a war hero. And she brought him in, or he was brought in, to her intimate circle of 20 or so friends with whom she could abandon protocol, play games, sort of like charades and so forth with penalties, and just be Catherine, not Matushka, the mother figure. And Potemkin was brought into this group, and she said, I hear a lot about you. I hear a lot of good things about you. I understand you're a wonderful mimic, and could you demonstrate this? So to the astonishment and concern of all the people there, he immediately mimicked her with her German accent. She spoke French, Russian, and German, and her body language. And the people there, although used to informality, thought this was going much too far and wondered what was going to happen to Colonel Potemkin. And what happened was that Catherine laughed and laughed and laughed. Mm. She thought that this is a special man. Their love letters, once they became intimate, you may or may not agree with the level of passion, but I think they sort of scorched the page. I've never read royal love letters of this kind, but it's not just fire and brimstone. It's also compassion, comfort, friendship, advice, et cetera, et cetera. And then when they came apart, the problem for Potemkin was that he was a man, and he wanted a woman to be a wife, or at least available, subservient in a sense. And she said in her letters and to him face to face, in a sense, the Russian version of, I understand what you're saying, sweetie, but I actually have an empire to run. And so I have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not always going to be available at the snap of your fingers. And he became surly. He made scenes, walked out slamming the door, or walked into a room where she was having a meeting with her ministers or generals, wearing only a silk robe open at the front. I mean, he was trying to establish the fact that he owned her, and that became difficult. So they reached this agreement that he would go off and to the south and control that as her viceroy, her general, her conqueror, that they would both be free to take other partners. But he was always her faithful servant, I would say her beloved. But and the letters changed from passion to, I'd say great affection and relying on each other. For she was the empress; she could give him the army, she could supply the troops, she could give him orders. He would carry them out in his own way. It was a remarkable relationship.
And the letters still remained intimate because she went on to tell him about her other lovers, her favorites. And when they first met, she had just had the three lovers. He became the fourth, and he was extremely jealous and demanded to know who they were and what had happened, and she told him.
And she wrote that extraordinary letter. I don't know any letter from a sovereign, male or female, of explanation and apology, but it wasn't really apology. She said, look, if my first husband had been somebody who loved me and whom I could love, I would have been faithful to him forever, but he wasn't. And what has happened is a result of that. And I haven't had 15 lovers, as you accuse me of, but I think she says, you're my fifth. And that was over, you know, by then she was 45 years old. So that is not extraordinary, even today in our complicated world. But they were an extraordinary pair. You're absolutely right.
She had a dozen lovers over the course of her life, and we
we
meet them all. And,
a dozen lovers and one husband.
And one husband.
Well, maybe two.
Or maybe two. The Empress Elizabeth.
But that would mean one less lover.
You're right. He was no lover, the first husband.
No, certainly not.
Right.
No. It's so pathetic and so grotesque that it's almost sympathetic. You know, you remember that Peter came down with smallpox, and the ravages to his face and body were so grim that she said she couldn't recognize him.
And that was really when he turned on her, because he had hoped.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Because she said one word and then walked away. She was just horrified. But you remember also that smallpox was then a deadly disease, very prevalent, and that Catherine, when she heard that there was a British doctor who was inoculating people against smallpox by, you know, giving them a very mild case, she was the first person in Russia to do that. Her son, Paul, was the second, and within a couple of years, 20,000 Russians had been inoculated, and within her lifetime, 2 million. And she did this despite the fact that almost universally she was told, warned, pleaded with, for goodness sakes, don't do this. You're too precious to us. Yeah. She went ahead.
There is so much in this book to talk about. We decided to bring you a second segment of our interview with Robert K. Massey for his book, Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. Tune in next week as we close out the year in the Book Nook with part two of our interview on this fascinating book. Thanks for listening. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.